Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 152 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Trista Crosley is having the time of her wheat life, about my conversation with the editor of the best wheat publication in the country and my friend and colleague. Although she's got fewer miles on her odometer than me, Trista and I are both graduates of journalism schools, and we were both attracted to the profession as an avenue to explore our curiosity as well as a means to express our creativity. Based on what our respective offices look like, I would argue I'm the more creative one, citing as evidence a 2013 study that found working in a messy room helps people try new things and come up with creative ideas. Of course, on the other hand, Trista can actually find things on her desk. Wheat Life, for those of you who might be listening outside of Eastern Washington, is a magazine published by the Washington Association of Wheat Growers, the sister organization of the Washington Grain Commission. The magazine, which is largely supported by advertising, is sent to all those who pay wheat assessments as well as a number of subscribers. It has a circulation of 13,000. Within its pages, the WGC has an 11-page section highlighting its research, marketing, and educational mandates. Although our journalism backgrounds are similar, Trista and I have different skill sets. She came out of school not only knowing how to write, she also understands how to design a pleasing arrangement of headlines, articles, photos, illustrations, and advertisements. It's definitely an art, and I'm always grateful for her magazine design skills as they consistently make my articles more attractive and readable. In fact, for many years before arriving at her Wheat Life gig, Trista traveled the country teaching newspapers how to use her then company's newspaper design technology. Her traveling days came to an end, however, when she arrived to train the staff at the Coeur d'Alene Press and met her future husband, Brian, who now works for the city of Spokane. I visited Trista at the pair's new home on Pion Prairie, located on a 10-acre parcel that is, appropriately enough, in a wheat rotation. Although building any new home is subject to challenges, Trista and Brian's home was especially problematic. You see, just after the pair purchased the property, the Washington State Supreme Court came down with the Hearst decision, which shut off all rural construction in the state, and as you'll hear ahead, had the pair wondering if they'd thrown their money down a dry well. Although I was aware of the Hearst decision because of the impact on agricultural lands, it was Trista's situation that brought the fallout front and center for me. And it's why I began our conversation by asking her to recount her house-building saga that, thankfully, was happily resolved.
Well, my husband works for the city of Spokane, so we were living in Coeur d'Alene at the time and wanted to move closer so it would cut his commute. And we were also looking for some space for a garden and then for some crafting that I wanted to get into. And we just kind of built from there, decided we'd start looking closer to Spokane, and had initially ruled this area out because we thought it was too expensive. And then just on a lark, I think Brian was looking at Zillow, and this property popped up. So we drove out here, and we didn't want 10 acres. We wanted maybe half an acre. So we came out here and just immediately fell in love with it, and just there was no looking back. And throughout this process, as we were building, anytime we started to question whether we were doing the right thing, we just would come out here and it was right. We felt right. So
yes, it felt right, but you had some hurdles to jump, right?
Yes. About 6 weeks after we closed on the property, the Hearst decision happened, which really stopped rural development or anything that was going to rely on a private well.
And the Hearst decision was that you had to prove that your well wouldn't impact streams and rivers?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, you had to get like a specialist come out, a geologist or somebody, and do a study that would prove that you're using water out of the aquifer wasn't going to impact any previous users in Washington's streams and rivers are considered a user. So basically it stopped rural development all across Washington state.
And during the process, did you think, oh my gosh, we've sunk all this money into the property and now it's going to be worthless? Or did you think that it would solve itself?
My husband was on the side of, oh my God, this is the worst mistake we ever made and we are going to lose everything and it's never going to get fixed and this land is going to be worthless. I was a little more positive because I couldn't imagine that the state would let all rural development stop like that. So I tended to be more on the positive side, but sure, there were times throughout it where it was like, oh, this is never going to happen.
And so it did eventually happen. Mm-hmm. The legislature took care of it about 15 months later, and you started building the house.
There was a little bit of a time gap in there, but yeah, after they passed that in January, I think we started construction about 6 months later.
Okay. These last years have been so wonderful with you as WheatLife editor. I don't know how long it's been that they've been so wonderful. How many years have you been editor?
I've been editor for about 7 years, and then 3 or 4 years before that, maybe only 2 or 3, I was in the background helping out the other editors doing some design work and some writing for them. Mm-hmm. So I think 2008 or 2009 is when I really got involved with WheatLife.
Wonderful, wonderful. Any ag in your background?
I grew up in a rural community. Place where I grew up grows a lot of fruit. We're known as the Fruitway of Utah, so a lot of peaches, a lot of stone fruit. And everybody I knew had huge gardens, and we had about a half-acre garden growing up. Much different kind of agriculture than I'm involved in now. But so I knew farming, a little bit about farming. I knew kind of how you grew food and some of the problems involved with it, but certainly not on the scale that wheat's grown out here.
I just want people to appreciate how much a half acre is. That's a half a football field. So when did you know that you wanted to go into journalism?
I remember writing stories as, you know, an 8 or 9 year old. In fact, when I was in third grade, my grandmother was my third grade teacher. I wrote a story about Frankenstein, who called everybody Gruesome, because my grandfather's nickname for my grandma was Gruesome. So I've always liked writing. At one point, I thought I would write Westerns, was obsessed with Westerns. And then when I got into college and realized that, hey, I can make a living writing, that's a pretty good deal.
Wonderful, wonderful. Trista, I think of myself as a curious guy. That's sort of what has motivated me into journalism. What's the trait that led you into journalism?
I always said my ideal job would be to be a student forever. I loved school. I loved going to classes. I loved learning, loved taking tests. So, you know, weird. But the idea of a job that I could look at things that I knew nothing about and learn about them, was and is very, very appealing. You know, this is not a job that you're going to get bored doing. It's never the same.
Yes. And, you know, coming into agriculture from the outside, sort of, well, I'm me more than you, perhaps, you can certainly satisfy your curiosity frequently in agriculture.
Yes.
So you and I are both communication professionals. I mean, I'm director of communications of the Washington Grain Commission, and you are editor of WheatLife. Now, I like to think I'm objective, but I write and speak with a wheat industry spin. How have you reconciled your journalistic training with the job you have now?
I think at the very basic level, it's all about imparting information. I mean, our job is to make the wheat industry look good, so you always kind of have to keep that in the back of your mind. But I try to be fair. Pretty much, I think every story has two sides of it, so I always try and get the other side of it, whether that's, you know, good or not for the wheat industry. I'd like to at least try to get that side of the story. So trying to be fair is important to me.
Yes. I always felt that in agriculture especially, there were always two sides of the story.
Probably three or four.
Now, I think that there are people out there, purists perhaps, who might think that we traffic in fake news. What is fake news anyway?
I think it's really subjective. For most people, I think fake news has become a way to say, I don't agree with this viewpoint, therefore it is not true, without maybe considering that it could be true. So I think it's become something that people hide behind when they don't want to hear a viewpoint other than their own. That's what I would call fake news.
Yes, I think that's fair. Over my history of working with agriculture, and specifically the wheat industry, I've seen my opinions about farming and farmers have changed. Have you undergone a similar metamorphosis?
I think I've certainly become more aware of the work that's involved in growing a commodity crop. That's much different than a half-acre garden, for sure. I've also become much more sympathetic to all of the regulations and the hoops that farmers have to jump through. I don't think many people realize how heavily regulated the industry is. So I think that's where I've really kind of grown and changed in regards to agriculture.
Yes, indeed. Now, I know you like to cook. Do you bake bread?
Yes, sourdough specifically.
Uh-huh. Any reason for sourdough specifically?
I like the taste better. it's kind of the whole wild yeast is, that process is fascinating to me, that you can take just like four ingredients, flour, water, salt, and then wild yeast, and you can make this thing that it has infinite varieties, you know, there, and it's comes from those four ingredients.
But there are some that suggest that because you have that wild yeast and because it ferments for much longer mm-hmm. than your fast-rise bread, that it is better for you and better for your gut. I mean, is that something that comes into it?
Not really. I think just the commercial varieties of bread that what you're going to buy from the store, they have a schedule they have to keep. They have to get bread out, and it has to get fast. It has to be the same. The product has to be the same no matter what batch that bread comes from, and that's nearly impossible when you're dealing with sourdough. So I like sourdough mostly because of the flavor. I've heard people say that sourdough and fermented things like that is easier in some people's guts. That may be the case. If it is, great. I just like the taste. And again, I like... Every time I make a loaf of bread, it's different. Even if I follow the exact same steps as I did the time before, I'm going to get a different product every time.
Now, do you have a bread recipe that is yours, or do you follow other people's recipes?
I usually start with other people's recipes, and then in the course of playing around with it and doing them, everybody changes it a little bit. But I'm not sure there's any original recipes out there anymore. Everything is a variation of something.
As someone who came into agriculture from the outside, and I'm speaking of myself, I think it gives me a perspective that those who grew up inside the industry can't have. Now, as someone who mirrors my experience in terms of coming in from the outside, at least commodity agriculture, what is agriculture missing when confronting its challenges?
I think one of the biggest, I don't know if I'd call it a problem, but I think farmers who dismiss the influence that the non-farming public has, I think they're in some regards pulling the wool over their eyes. People want to know where their food comes from. They want to know how it's grown. And as the population continues to swing from, used to be a majority of people were farmers and now they're not, that influence and that pressure is going to keep growing. And I don't think a farmer, maybe 50 years ago they could do this, but I don't think a farmer can just stay on their land and kind of sit tight and just hope that nothing is going to influence them. I just don't think that's realistic anymore. So I think farmers have to maybe step back and look at the public and take into consideration some of the concerns the public has and figure out a way to deal with it.
Well, the figuring out how to deal with it.
Yes, I know. We both do work on that, don't we?
Yes. Okay. The Washington Association of Wheat Growers, and you work for the Washington Association of Wheat Growers, has an almost all-woman staff, and more women are involved in all aspects of the industry all the time. Any thoughts on the influx of women into the industry?
Well, I would like to think it's because misconceptions about what a woman can or can't or shouldn't do are changing. I think maybe there's a generational shift happening that women are looking at areas where before they were maybe discouraged from entering and saying, hey, I can do that. And hopefully it just keeps happening.
You have been working as editor of Wheat Life for 7 years now, and that means, you know, 11 months a year you have to get out this pretty large magazine on a short staff. How difficult is it to get Wheat Life out every month?
You know, some months are easier than others. Sometimes it goes right up until deadline. I'm not sure what the magazine's going to look like, but it's definitely a team effort. I might be called the editor, but there's a whole team of people that I work with. Obviously, you are responsible for quite a bit of content in the magazine, and I'm always appreciative when you meet your deadline. But there's Kevin Gaffney, who sells the ads, and without the ads, we wouldn't have a magazine. And then you've got the ladies at the WOG office, Michelle Hennings, Lori Williams, and Shauna Carlson, and they deal with billing, they deal with circulation, they field questions. A lot of the times, if I'm in a bind, I can go to them, and they'll do what they can to help me out. So it's definitely a team effort.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, Trista, I'm an introvert, and after 10 years, well, no, after, so it just feels like 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay, serious. Trista, I'm an introvert, and after 7 years working with you, I assume you're an introvert too. Why is it, you think, that introverts get involved in an occupation that requires them to act more like an extrovert?
You know, every time I get behind a microphone or I get in front of the camera, I ask myself that question. I don't know. I certainly didn't anticipate that that was going to happen to me when I started doing this. I think people get interested about what we do. Maybe that's why.
Yes, yes. Well, and you know, we're very good at asking questions and getting other people
that's
to talk.
That's absolutely right. I can ask questions like nobody's business, but I'm not real good at answering them.
Yes, I agree. Now, most writers think of themselves as creative. Does Wheat Life scratch your creative itch, or do you get satisfaction elsewhere?
For the most part, it does. I've always been interested in more than just the writing part of journalism. Out of journalism school, I kind of very quickly went into the production side. So I love being able to take text and photos and put them together with different fonts, different arrangements, so that tells a story just as much as the actual story does. That's what I really love. To be able to take this magazine from nothing at the beginning of each month to a finished product that I can hold in my hands and look at it and say, with a lot of help, I did this. So yeah, it does.
Yeah. Oh yes, I absolutely understand that. Absolutely. So do you have any hobbies?
I do, besides baking. I do stained glass, and I read quite a bit, like to walk quite a bit, and my husband and I like to do traveling. Traveling is kind of, yeah, that's our...
That's your thing.
That's our thing, yes.
All right. Trista, we all have our bad days. Professionally, what does a good day look like to you?
I think a good day is when... You know, I start out each day with a list of things that I have to get done that day and things that I'd like to get done. So when I can get through that list at the end of the day and they're all checked off, that's a darn good day for me.
And do you actually have a physical list?
Oh, yeah. I live and die by my lists. It's a way to keep me organized. It keeps me focused because there's a lot of juggling involved of people and of ideas and of stories and deadlines. I live and die by my lists.
Now I keep a list too. I mean, I write it out. Do you write it
out? Yes. In fact, I have a notebook that I have each day, and each day I have a list of the things that I need to get done that day.
Once again, you're more organized than me. I just have a piece of paper.
You know, I tried to do that, but I kept losing them.
Okay. What have you come to appreciate about wheat farming and wheat farmers over your tenure?
I think I would extend that out to just farmers in general. I think farmers are some of the nicest, most generous people you'll ever meet, whether you agree with them or not. They're always willing, at least I found, they're always willing to, you know, drop what they're doing and answer questions. Being new to agriculture or this type of agriculture, I had a lot of questions coming in, and there were farmers that if I didn't understand something, I knew I could call them and ask them, and they would explain what was happening and why it was important. They're just people who are trying to make a living like anybody else.
My first 3 years involved in agriculture, I began each interview with, I know this is a stupid question, but...
Yeah, there are definitely times when I've done the same.
What's the best thing about being editor of Wheat Life, and what's the worst thing?
The best thing for me is getting out there and meeting people. Everybody has a story to tell. Some of them may not realize that. With the right question, you can find anybody's story out. So just meeting people and getting to know them. The worst thing is when the phone rings and I have somebody on the other end and they're upset because of something, an inaccuracy or something that I got wrong in the magazine. That makes my heart drop.
Oh, you know, me too.
You hate those phone calls. You know you're going to get them, but it's really hard.
It is. I don't think people realize how much we want to be factual and true and accurate, and when we aren't, it really hurts.
It really does. It's almost makes me feel sick when somebody calls up and says, you know, you got this wrong, and you just kind of hope that people understand it's never malicious. You never did it on purpose. There's just, you're juggling so many balls that sometimes things fall through.
Sometimes it's something as little as spelling a name wrong.
Oh,
I feel horrible when I spell a name wrong.
Yes, me too. Everybody wants their name to be spelled right when they see it in print. So, yeah, that's definitely a bad day.
Yeah. We constantly hear about media outlets that are taking it on the chin. Magazines are closing, newspapers are closing. How is Wheat Life doing from a business point of view?
I think we're holding steady. Just like farmers out there, we are starting to feel the effects of low prices. Another thing that we're seeing an effect on is as farms get bigger and there are fewer farmers, we have fewer people out there to talk to, readers. So yeah, I think we're doing okay, but it's definitely, we're feeling the pressure.
Any thought given to making Wheat Life an online publication only?
Yes. I think with the state of print media these days, it would be short-sighted not to. The biggest problem that we would have to solve, and this is certainly not unique to Wheat Life, is advertising. The way that, in my opinion, the way that a reader interacts with you know, what they're reading online versus on print is very, very different. And so advertising online is a hurdle that I don't think anybody has been able to solve yet. And if you do it wrong, you can turn people off so quickly. So yeah, it's something that I'm looking at, something that I'm always kind of in the back of my mind thinking, is there a way that we could do this online? But so far, I haven't figured out a way to do that.
How do you consume your news?
Mostly online. I pretty much almost exclusively now online.
There was a point in my life that I looked at the folks who were reading online and I said, never, never. And now I do most of it online, yeah.
I will say when I'm reading for pleasure, it's kind of a mix between books and electronic, but news-wise and getting my information, that's almost exclusively online.
As an old newspaper reporter myself, I held the line for many years, subscribing to local and national papers and periodicals that were delivered to my front door and added to my recycling. But my purchase of an iPad a few years ago changed that, and like Trista, I've gone almost all electronic in my reading, which is easy to do if you live in or nearby a connected city or town. But I believe poor internet connectivity in the country does not make it feasible to even consider putting Wheat Life online at this time, not to mention the challenge Trista addressed concerning advertisers. Connectivity is a problem for this podcast as well, which is why I urge my listeners to download multiple episodes while they're at their parts store or warehouse company, or even in their truck outside local libraries, most of which have faster connectivity than I do in Spokane. Please remember to like or follow the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page as another way to get the latest updates about the podcasts I post each Tuesday, like episode 152, which I entitled, Trista Crosley is having the time of her wheat life. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our glue, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.